Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We'll spend some time now talking about the role of Steve Bannon in the Trump administration and looking at his beliefs. Bannon, as most of you know, was executive chairman of the conservative populist Breitbart website before joining the Trump campaign. He's now Trump's chief strategist, but also seems to be playing a central policy, not just strategy or political role. He reportedly wrote much of the inaugural address, has been given a seat on the National Security Council, a vital policy role, and crafted much of the 90-day, seven-country travel ban seen by critics as the first volley in a broader Muslim ban and even religious war. Here is a montage of Bannon's statements that lend some credence to that critique. USA Today put this montage together this week from moments on Bannon's own radio show on Breitbart, things he said in the last year and a half before leaving Breitbart for the campaign.
You know, George Bush walked out after 9/11 in front of a mosque, it's religion of peace and go shopping, right? We haven't had an adult conversation. And by the way, some of these conversations may get a little unpleasant, but you know what? We're in a war. We're clearly going into, a major shooting war in the Middle East again. It's war. Every day we put up America's at war. We're at war. Note to self, beloved commander-in-chief, we're at war.
You have an expansionist Islam and you have an expansionist China, right? They are motivated, they're arrogant, they're on the march, and they think the Judeo-Christian West is on the retreat. Talk to us about this mosque in the North Pole.
Various Steve Bannon statements from his Breitbart radio show in the last year and a half before he joined the Trump campaign. Here's one more example. This is Bannon on Breitbart knocking not just radical Islamists, but Islam as a religion overall in the context of knocking George W. Bush in this Breitbart radio clip last year.
Well, you know, George Bush did look into Vladimir Putin's eyes, and what he said, he saw a evangelical Christian, a deeply religious man. Was that not the second dumbest comment that one of the dumbest presidents in the history of these United States, that would be Bush 43, Shrub, as they call him. He made the dumbest being that Islam is a religion of peace. The second dumbest was that, you know, he looked into the soul of Vladimir Putin when he looked into his eyes and saw a devout Christian. I think they had a bromance going on, but that's a topic for a different day.
Interesting that he was also critical of Putin there, sometimes seen positively by that philosophical camp. But let's learn more about Steve Bannon, his views, and his influence in the White House so far with New York Times correspondent Scott Shane, who wrote a Bannon profile in November, and Eliana Johnson, who recently joined Politico from National Review. She has an article this week called "The Man Behind Trump, Still Steve Bannon." Hi, Scott. Hi, Eliana. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
And listeners, what do you want to say or ask about Steve Bannon and his influence on U.S. policy now? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Scott, can you put those clips we played into context? Are they part of a larger Bannon worldview, particularly with respect to Islam, not just radical Islam?
I guess if I had to sum up Steve Bannon's worldview from, you know, what he's said and written over the years, the sort of domestic component would be that the elites, the political and financial elites, have essentially exploited the working class and the middle class and need to be overthrown. We could talk about how that fits in with the billionaires in the Trump cabinet, but that he said that many times, especially to Tea Party groups over the years. And then internationally, you know, I think his biggest theme is that what he calls the Judeo-Christian West is at war, in a global war with radical Islam. And sometimes he drops the radical and just says Islam. And occasionally he's very well read, and you know, he'll cite history. And in one talk, he went back to Vienna and Tours, the city in France, both sites of famous battles between Christians and Muslims, in which the Christians, you know, stopped Muslim invaders. And so he connects the kind of current era with those kinds of apocalyptic kind of confrontations, clash of civilizations between Muslims and Christians, you know, centuries ago.
And Eliana, do you think we see that sneering sarcasm about Islam translated into policy and legalese in the 90-day travel ban?
You know, I think that in part of Bannon's worldview, there's an aspect of intentional provocation, overstatement, and so dropping the radical Islam and just saying Islam, and this idea that attacking, even destroying sacred cows is a good thing. I think that's what attracted him to Trump in part. And so I think you did see that with the sort of shock and awe of these executive orders, which some people have said, you know, are more showmanship than actual you know, policy muscle. So I think you really do see Steve Bannon's fingerprints on, particularly on these executive orders about immigration, and a real desire to show that Trump meant what he said on the campaign trail and will follow through on it. These are as much messaging tools to the Trump base as they are serious policy documents.
Scott, as your profile points out, Bannon went to a military Catholic school as a kid in Richmond, Virginia, was a naval officer, then went to Harvard Business School and worked for Goldman Sachs and also started his own investment firm, made a fortune apparently by investing in Seinfeld reruns. There was some foresight. He's still profiting from that, I guess. He's 63 years old and describes himself as an economic nationalist but not a white nationalist. You also say respect for his father, who's still alive at 95 and they're close, who is a telephone lineman, motivates him in some way. Can you talk about that?
Sure. He was a telephone. His dad was a telephone lineman initially, and eventually worked his way up into sort of middle management at the telephone company. But you know, he sees himself as a representative of sort of average working people, the middle class. And you know, many people who know him says that a turning point for him was the 2008 financial crisis, which, you know, in his view, the sort of the financial elite weathered very well, but people like his dad, who apparently, you know, lost some of the value of his retirement accounts, you know, really suffered, and that sort of lit his fire. As you say, he became quite wealthy in the business world, and then you know, got into producing movies and doing various jobs in Hollywood, and then sort of gradually moved into the political sphere, first by making documentary films, and subsequently when he took over Breitbart News, the right-wing news site. And that was sort of, I guess you could say, the launching pad that now has landed him via Donald Trump at the White House.
Eliana, picking up on the economic side of Bannon that Scott was just talking about, there are contradictions here, it seems to me. And I wonder if it's not just Bannon, but kind of the, you know, that wing of conservative economic populists generally, and maybe you can help explain it. Like, they disdain Wall Street, but they want Dodd-Frank repealed or weakened, which is what Wall Street banks want. They want little guys like Bannon's father not to get screwed by the powerful, but I think they oppose minimum wage laws. They oppose Democratic Party programs like free public college for working class Americans and some kind of national health insurance law, if not Obamacare, something that smooths out the ravages of the private marketplace and doesn't give as much power to insurance companies. Do you understand it? Do you get how those things hang together?
I'm actually not sure that the economic views that that you just laid out are those of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. Trump said repeatedly on the campaign trail that he opposed entitlement reform, touching Medicare and Medicaid. And I'm not sure what Steve Bannon's views on the minimum wage are, but it would not surprise me to hear that he supported a minimum wage. I just don't know the particulars of his economic views. I think it's fair to say that traditional conservative economic views, which are what you just laid out, sort of the trickle-down theory of economics, are not those of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, and that he's really seeking to replace neoconservative foreign policy views and conservative free market economic views with an entirely different ideology, which is, much more friendly to, much more liberal. And so I would not equate the two. I think precisely as Scott said, that he sees himself as a tribune of the working class and an enemy sort of bureaucrats, bankers, the Davoisie, Davos attending people, academics, it's just not clear to me what precisely his views are on economic policy.
The Davoisie. And Scott, this is in your article too. You write about contradictions within Bannon, and you ask, for example, why does a man who calls himself a hard-nosed capitalist rail against globalists and the party of Davos, as he calls it? So how would you begin to answer that question?
You know, on economics, it really is a bit of a puzzle. Some of the things that certainly President Trump and some of those he's appointed seem to stand for, and certainly Republican Congress stands for, seem to be at odds with things Bannon has said. One of the things that struck me in November, I listened to a whole lot of Steve Bannon. A lot of his speeches to the Tea Party groups and that kind of thing are on YouTube. And one of the things that you find is that you could take, three, four, five sentences at a time, and if I showed it to someone who was up to speed on American politics, they would not be able to tell me whether that was Bernie Sanders or Steve Bannon. So there is this sort of populist sticking up for the little man side to Bannon, or at least his rhetoric, and how that squares with some of what, we expect from President Trump and the Republican Congress is, it's very, very hard to figure out. But to amplify what Eliana said about Bannon in terms of style, we may be looking too hard at sort of for consistent policies. Like President Trump, this is a guy with a background to a degree in showbiz. He, produced a bunch of films. He certainly understands symbols. He understands messaging. And there is this streak. A guy who worked with him on a documentary years ago talked about how they got into a bit of an argument over whether the documentary had to be cut further. It was, 2 hours and 15 minutes, and he said, look, we can't. It has to be shorter, and Bannon didn't want to cut it. And he said Bannon turned the table they were sitting at over. He said one thing about Steve is everything has to be a fight. And I think, when you think about what he said to my colleague in the New York Times the other day, that the media is the opposition party. I mean, he's, this is all very intentional. I think when, many folks looked at the immigration order and talked about bungling and it didn't go through the proper process and it was surprised the leaders at DHS and the State Department actually have to carry it out and treated that as a big mistake. But I think it's fair, as Eliana suggests, to assume that in Bannon's view this is not a mistake, that the whole idea was to rally the base, to make liberals cry out in pain and sort of on with the revolution.
My guests are New York Times correspondent Scott Shane and Politico correspondent Eliana Johnson. As we look at the record and influence in the White House so far of Steve Bannon, 212-433-WNYC. Our lines are full right now, but you can get in as people finish up. And we'll start with Josh in Midtown. Josh, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
So I listen to you every day. I'm trying to, you know, make sense of all this. And, you know, one of the things I want to know is, so let's say Bannon, he wants to make liberals cry out. He sounds purposeful. He clearly thinks he's brilliant. I mean, he's very taken with himself. And then what I see happens is people say, well, you know, he's a brilliant guy. He knows what he's doing. What I want to know is, what is he missing? Like, what are the consequences of his behavior that he doesn't see? You know, what are potential backfires?
Politically?
Yeah, I mean, politically, you know, politically and even events that could happen that he just doesn't see as possible that could happen that would surprise him.
That's a big question. Did you also tell our screener that you had a question, who is Trump to Bannon?
Yes, that yes, I did. You know, who is Trump to Bannon? Because, you know, he was making fun of Bush, saying that he wasn't intelligent, that he said stupid things. I mean, the problem that I'm having with Trump, you know, I listened to your, you know, conservative listeners, and I just don't get what people see in Trump. You know, he doesn't even seem to know who Frederick Douglass is.
Josh, I'm gonna leave it there, and let's take that second Josh question, which I think is more of a manageable one to actually maybe get an answer to. Eliana, who is Trump to Bannon? And if Bannon thinks George W. Bush was stupid, does he think Trump is intelligent?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if people are trying to understand Trump through a traditional Republican-Democrat political framework, they're not going to be able to understand him. I think the best way to understand Trump is as a third party candidate or president. He's, you know, a politician like the country's never really seen before. He's a nationalist populist who's sort of running a coalition government where he's going to agree with Republicans in Congress on some things and agree with Democrats on other things. But to try to understand him through the framework of Republican politics and policy, I think is misleading.
Right.
And I think Bannon is very similar. And I think Bannon was attracted to Trump because he exists outside of the traditional political framework and can really overthrow and affect an enormous amount of change in government because he's willing to flout norms and be entirely contradictory to everything we've seen come before this. Bannon's presence, the breaking down of the wall that has existed between politics and policy, where your political advisor doesn't sit on the National Security Council, I think is one example. But it's just a small part of the changes I think we're going to see in the Trump presidency.
I agree with that. And Scott, you referred at one point in your article to Trump as Bannon's Reagan. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I was interested to discover that, first of all, that as a young naval officer, Bannon got very excited by Ronald Reagan. He was from a Democratic family, traditionally Democratic family. But like a lot of Democrats, they went for Reagan. And he happened to talk his way into, with a couple friends, into Reagan's sort of election night victory party in 1980. And it was clearly a formative, you know, memorable experience for him. Subsequently, he made a film called In the Face of Evil, which is essentially a kind of hagiographic portrait of Reagan as a very strong leader facing off against the global menace of communism. And I think, you know, what there's evidence that he sort of tried out various politicians as potential vehicles for the ideas that he wanted to press. And, you know, so he made films about Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. He talked to a number of other folks who were considering presidential runs. But clearly there was a kind of kinship between him and Trump. in terms of their love for the spectacular, their love for being contrarian. I guess also one thing, you know, that a guy who didn't want to be named, but who's quite close to Bannon, and who said to Bannon during the campaign, you know, basically, Trump is an idiot. Why are you supporting this guy? He has no knowledge of policy or anything else. And Bannon, in defending his decision to go with Trump, called Trump an imperfect vessel, which President Trump might take some offense at. But the idea of a vessel is something empty that you pour something into. And, you know, for as long as this relationship lasts, I think, you know, Steve Bannon, who is full of ideas and is, whatever else you say about him, is very well informed on a lot of things, does a lot of reading, he's going to pour his ideas into Donald Trump, and we'll see how that comes out. The other thing, I guess, that the caller made me think about, we were talking about how this executive order was, you know, kind of a political act, an act of defiance and showmanship and, you know, carrying out a campaign promise. And it was certainly signaling to Trump's base that, you know, you heard me promise that I was going to get tough on immigration and on Muslims, and that's exactly what we're doing. I guess the thing that disturbs people in the counterterrorism world that I've covered for a long time is that, you know, you may be signaling to your American base, you're also signaling to a lot of other folks. And ISIS and al-Qaeda, of course, push and thrive on the idea that the U.S. is at war with Islam. You know, and they say all Muslims have to join our cause because there's nowhere else to go. You know, the U.S. is against you. Both President Bush, George W. Bush, and President Obama were very careful to separate al-Qaeda and ISIS on the one hand from the great mass of Muslims on the other hand.
And by the way, the Times has a really interesting article today about Putin and how careful he is to do that. When he talks about radical Islamist extremists, he makes a point of saying, I'm not talking about Islam. And he doesn't use that language of, you know, radical Islamic terrorism that Trump and the Republican Party generally prefer, but rather tries to go the way of violent political extremists, things like that, that President Obama and the Democrats do. So it's interesting that that comes from Putin.
Yeah, we actually have a story in today's New York Times about the sort of school of, I think it's fair to call, anti-Muslim sentiments and views that has thrived on the political right, but sort of on the fringe for many, many years. And that school, I think it's fair to say, has sort of moved into the White House between Bannon talking about, you know, this global war against Islamic radicalism and Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, who tweeted at one point last year, "Fear of Muslims is rational." You know, they have kind of stepped outside the traditional or the, you know, the sort of White House stance of the previous two presidents, who were very careful to separate Islam from terrorism.
I have to,
and now they're sort of being conflated.
I have to go to a short break, but I actually want to pick up with both of you on exactly that point when we come back. And ask if you get the sense that the travel ban is just the start of something bigger. It is only temporary, 90 days, and it is only with respect to 7 countries. Is it the start of something bigger with respect to Muslims in or out of this country that we can expect from Bannon and Trump? So get ready for that question, and listeners will take more of your calls, too, as we continue on Steve Bannon with Scott Shane from The New York Times and Eliana Johnson from Politico. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about the role of Steve Bannon in the Trump administration and looking at his beliefs with Scott Shane, New York Times correspondent, who wrote a lengthy profile of Bannon in the Times in November, and Eliana Johnson, who recently joined Politico from National Review. She's got an article this week called "The Man Behind Trump, Still Steve Bannon." For listeners who are just tuning in, which would be a lot of people from when we started a half hour ago, I want to replay the montage of things Steve Bannon has said that mostly have to do with war and Islam that USA Today put together this week. These are things Bannon said on his Breitbart radio show, which he gave up when he joined the campaign.
You know, George Bush walked out after 9/11 in front of a mosque. It's religion of peace and go shopping, right? We haven't had an adult conversation. And by the way, some of these conversations may get a little unpleasant. But you know what? We're in a war. We're clearly going into, a major shooting war in the Middle East again. It's war. It's war. Every day we put up America's at war. America's at war. We're at war. Note to self, beloved Commander-in-Chief, we're at war.
You have an expansionist Islam and you have an expansionist China, right? They are motivated. They're arrogant. They're on the march and they think the Judeo-Christian West is on the retreat. Talk to us about this mosque in the North Pole.
Various Steve Bannon clips from about the last year and a half on Breitbart Radio before he joined the Trump campaign last summer. Eliana Johnson, I want to pick up on one of the lines in that. When he said he thinks we're headed for another major shooting war in the Middle East, he, from everything I know, hated the Iraq war, hates George W. Bush for, among other things, squandering so much American money on the Iraq war when people like his working class father could use that spent on them to get by. And now he seems to, at least in that one line, I don't want to take it too much out of context, but it seems to fit in the context of the travel ban and other things that he said, of almost goading us into another major shooting war in the Middle East. Does this fit together in any way that you understand?
I think it does. I think you need to note that Bannon has been extremely critical, not only of the foreign policy of George W. Bush, but also of the foreign policies of Barack Obama. And I think you could really see this come through in Trump's inaugural address, where he was tacitly critical, really, of the bipartisan foreign policy consensus that has existed in the post-World War II era. And I think what came through there was that the America's role as the provider of stability, the policeman of the world, has not served the middle class in this country. And I think what you're going to see under Trump, you're starting to see it, in this friendliness with Russia and other great powers that potentially could take the U.S.'s place elsewhere in the world, is a retreat back to American shores, a building of walls around this country. And I actually don't think Bannon would be a proponent of U.S. involvement in shooting wars around the world. I think I think America First is meant literally. It's intended, as a real isolationist sentiment, and he thinks his involvement in wars have really hurt the working class.
So when Trump says we're going to destroy ISIS and quickly, is that something Bannon would try to talk him out of in a military sense?
No, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you're going to see Trump follow something of an Obama policy, which is extremely reluctant to use ground troops, but to take a very strong posture, stronger than Obama in terms of his words and his self-presentation. But I think that this administration will be incredibly reluctant to put boots on the ground anywhere around the world.
Jim in Seacliff, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Jim. Yep, we can hear you.
Fantastic. I just want to ask your guest. Last Friday was Holocaust Memorial Remembrance Day. And I believe it was Mr. Bannon who made a speech or issued an address and failed to mention Jews. which...
Right. And I'm gonna go because the line is terrible. But this is a question we've been getting a lot, Scott. The statement, I think it was a written statement for Holocaust Remembrance Day, which in the past, coming from the White House, has mentioned Jews in particular, and in this case, didn't. So it wasn't Holocaust denial with respect to the Jews, but it's something that Jews are very wary of. When some people who want to downplay the Holocaust against the Jews, the genocide against the Jews, kind of put the Holocaust in general terms, you know, Germany's victimization of so many people. So it had that smell to some Jews. Was that Steve Bannon's work, and was that something that was intentionally intended to convey that message?
You know, I'm not certain of that, and Eliana might have more insight into it. I will say that, you know, Bannon ran the Breitbart News website prior to joining the campaign just last August. And, you know, that site, whatever Bannon's personal feelings are about different religious and ethnic minorities and immigrants and Muslims and so on, that site... is, it's fair to say, thrives on provocation, on incitement, and often uses headlines, has used headlines that are offensive to Jews, offensive to Muslims, offensive to African Americans, offensive to women. And, you know, whether that was a deliberate provocation or, you know, just sort of a clumsy misstep of a new administration. I don't know. Eliana, do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, my only insight is that the statement was not written by Bannon, but it's very difficult, I think, to get in the minds of these people and know whether it was intentionally provocative or whether the administration merely overlooked the inclusion of, you know, a specific reference to Jews. But I do think it's fair to say this is an administration that clearly doesn't have you know, specific procedures in place to run, you know, any statement about the Holocaust by X number of people or any, even its press statements by, you know, the 15 people who are supposed to see it. So I do think we know that, but I don't know whether it was intentional.
Alexis in Philadelphia, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alexis.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. This topic is a bit of my obsession right now, and I think that I don't know what you would call it, the elevation of Bannon to the entity is particularly worrisome. But I wanted to sort of ask or comment on, after the White Nationalist Conference that occurred right after Trump's election, I remember reading an article from NPR where I believe it was Richard Spencer who had said that their goal was like a 50-year ban on immigration with the exception of Christians from some European countries. And, you know, the article was referencing the connection to Bannon as well as how Jeff Sessions was the ideal AG for this agenda to go through in the U.S. And it's also the same article in which I believe it was Jared Taylor who referred to Trump as a vessel, like Scott just mentioned previously. That they admitted that even though he wasn't a white nationalist, they saw him as a vessel through which their ideals and policy could take life in our country.
So your question is, how much do you think that that those things are really Bannon's goals?
Yes, and how, you know, is in what you said right before the break, you know, is the refugee ban from these seven countries or the Muslim ban from these seven countries just sort of a first step?
Mm-hmm.
Toward this 50-year, you know, ban on, you know, all but Europeans to reestablish the 80% to 90% white Christian balance in our country.
Alexis, thank you. And so let's go right to that question, Scott. Are there any indications to think that this 90-day ban that's supposed to assess terrorism risks from seven mostly Muslim countries and people coming here from there? Just the start of something bigger with respect to Muslims and maybe even Mexicans in or out of this country?
You know, I don't think we know for sure yet. There has been talk about extending that ban on visas for some countries and maybe not for others. You know, this is a kind of a trial balloon, I suppose, and they may assess how it was received. But it's certainly unnerving to a lot of folks that it, you know, who are not convinced that this is a kind of temporary one-time measure. I don't think, you know, Bannon has a few times described himself, as you noted at the outset, as an economic nationalist, not a white nationalist. And he has mildly distanced himself from kind of the outright racism and xenophobia of people like Richard Spencer, who the caller mentioned, and the alt-right, so-called. But, you know, he's played it down. He's sort of been dismissive of it. He said every movement, you know, picks up some fringe characters, but that doesn't define the movement and so on. But he hasn't, you know, what he hasn't done that I think we've seen politicians and their top aides do in the past is sort of draw a bright line and clearly distance himself from these
right.
Extreme voices.
But I would almost make a distinction between two different kinds of white nationalism, if you will. The old KKK style, which maybe that Richard Spencer rally still represents, is primarily aimed in this country against blacks and Jews. What might be the Bannon style is more of a sort of Euro-Judeo-Christian nationalism, where they think that Western, European, Judeo-Christian, Western values and culture are under attack. Muslims in large numbers from anywhere are unassimilable. Latin Americans in large numbers are unassimilable. And those are the lines that he's really trying to draw to protect not just strict economic things like not too many immigrants so there isn't downward pressure on wages, things like that, but the sense of a white Judeo-Christian European culture that they think is uniquely valuable and is under threat with that much immigration. Is that – you think I'm off base there?
I think you've put it very well. I mean, one thing that you see when you look back at Bannon is, you know, some similarities and some ties to the kind of nationalist parties that have arisen in Europe and similar attitudes. You know, there is a real kind of coalition. A lot of those folks are big fans of Donald Trump. So I think that's right. You shouldn't really think of sort of cross-burning and the KKK. You should think more about these new style conservative nationalist leaders who have thrived on the resentment of immigration into Europe. You know, of course, far fewer immigrants have come to this country, relatively speaking. And, you know, in Germany, which accepted 1 million refugees, you know, that's just a totally different scale from what we're mm-hmm, seeing in this
right.
country. But the feelings are very similar.
And we're just about out of time. We're really over time. But, Eliana, we haven't mentioned on the program today in any of our segments the incident at Berkeley last night and Milo Yiannopoulos, who's a Breitbart guy in general. And we don't have time for me to go through the whole history of Yiannopoulos and how he was banned for life by Twitter for trolling Leslie Jones after Ghostbusters and all you know, this stuff. I think anti-feminist and anti-LGBT, even though he's gay himself, provocation, anti-political correctness provocation is Milo Yiannopoulos' main thing. But is he a Bannon disciple as somebody who became big at Breitbart doing all this stuff?
He is, and I think that this hits on another aspect of Bannon's strategy, which is not only to displace conservatism with nationalism and populism, but to provoke the left in a way that pushes them further left. And so with Milo being shut down and kicked out, I think it brings forth some untoward aspects of the opposition to Trump and to Bannon and their movement that I think in Bannon's eyes makes them look ridiculous, brings out the fringe aspect.
I agree. I think he got exactly what he was after at Berkeley last night, didn't he?
Exactly. And I think that you're going to see that more and more. I think there was an aspect of that to the executive order where these things are very closely held, privately held, and then dropped like, you know, a 1,000-pound bomb. And because they're a little bit disorganized, there are some mistakes in it, the opposition loses its mind and behaves in ways that make them look bad, and the attention shifts to that.
All right. To be continued. Eliana Johnson from Politico, Scott Shane from The New York Times. Thank you so much for giving us so much time today.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with us now, with the courage to look at himself in the mirror and the audacity to look at major news organizations, is Nate Silver, the founder and editor-in-chief of ESPN's data journalism site, 538. Nate is publishing a series of articles that will, for the most part, analyze how conventional horse race journalism assessed the election, but also what the pollsters got right and wrong and poll aggregation analytics sites like his own. The series is called The Real Story of 2016. Hi, Nate. Welcome back to WNYC. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
First, for openness sake, listeners may be hearing this and thinking to themselves, 538 got the election wrong, too, with their projections. So what gives you the high ground to assess other media outlets?
Well, for one thing, the way we look at the world is in terms of probability and uncertainty. And we spent a lot of time throughout the election saying that we thought people thought Clinton had it in the bag when they shouldn't have thought that. When the data told a more ambiguous story, we have a forecast model that had Trump with about a 30% chance. You know, that's a not unlikely event. That's Dustin Pedroia or David Ortiz or Derek Jeter getting a base hit or something like that. But you know, we think there needs to be more statistical literacy, and we think that starts with people distinguishing between a 30% chance, say, for example, and a 1% chance where some other forecasts had the race. I mean, those are really different forecasts, and those affected the way we cover the campaign in terms of taking Trump's chances seriously. And I say this is a website that I think we had all types of problems in the Republican primary. 2015, we thought Trump, I mean, this can't really be happening, can it? But we thought people made the opposite mistake in the general election, the same mistake, really, underrating his chances when the polls showed actually a race that was very competitive in the Electoral College.
Yeah, and you gave Trump, by the end of the campaign, and really through the campaign, a better chance of winning the election than most media polls, though you still wound up on Election Day with Clinton having about a 70% chance of winning, right?
Yeah, look, I think Clinton, I mean, it's not a matter of opinion, really. I mean, Clinton was favored based on the polls, but the point is that people treat it as though this was Reagan versus Mondale when it was maybe, you know, Bush versus Gore or something, a close election. I mean, she was ahead in most polls, but people were looking at polls that showed her 2 or 3 points ahead in a bunch of swing states. On average, you go back to 1968, polls missed by an average of 2 or 3 points. So all that meant is that if you had an average-sized polling error, and it was in Trump's favor instead of Clinton's favor, then you potentially had Trump winning the Electoral College. You know, and why people didn't see that, because to us it seemed like, you know, it was a little bit kind of an emperor has no clothes moment where it's like, this is a close election, and people weren't processing that somehow. In 2012, we kind of had the opposite problem where people were insistent that it was a toss-up between President Obama and Mitt Romney when Obama's position in the Electoral College was actually a lot stronger than Clinton, and we can talk about why that was. But I don't know. To me, it was a case where the conventional wisdom got really far out ahead of itself and kind of ignored
evidence from polling, from demographics, from economics, from other things that suggested that Trump had a real credible shot at winning on November 8th.
People are starting to call in, so let me give out the number for everybody else if you want to talk to Nate Silver, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. To your point, there was a moment just after the Billy Bush Access Hollywood tape came out, which was early October, so it was pretty close to the election, just a month in advance, where a lot of the media was saying, oh, now it's really collapsing for Trump. This could wind up being a landslide win. And was that based on the fact that the polls were really volatile and people were coming and going from the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign, and if the election was held on, you know, October 9th, 2 days after that tape came out, it really would have been a landslide? Or was that the news media and the analysts on television really getting ahead of the numbers?
I think people should have been careful about the fact that there was still a long ways to go in the campaign and that there were a lot of undecided voters. So there were definitely moments when you had Clinton, for example, at 45% of the vote and Trump at 39% of the vote. That's about where it was after the Access Hollywood tape. You know, 39% is really bad for a major party candidate, but 45% is also a long way from having clinched much of anything. And when Clinton had her own problems in the news cycle later in the race, and Trump was able to come back enough to win the Electoral College. But look, you know, our contention is that especially the national polling actually did a fairly good job. So we tend to take the polling relatively at face value when it says that if you had held an election in early October, Clinton might have won the popular vote by 6 points. She wound up winning the popular vote by 2 points, which is not that radically different as far as the popular vote goes. But, of course, that led 4 or 5 or 6 states, which were very close, to swing from Clinton to Trump. But yeah, look, polls and people respond to events in the news cycle. And I think part of the problem was that people were looking after the debates, which went pretty well for Clinton. She was up 5 or 6 or 7 points. Then you had Comey letter, you had WikiLeaks, you had maybe people coming back to Trump because of partisanship. I mean, it's, you know, it's a partisan country. It tends to be pretty 50-50. And so the race tightened a lot in the final 10 days, going from a 6-point Clinton lead to a 3-point Clinton lead in national polls. According to our model, she was actually vulnerable in the Electoral College when the lead got to 2 or 3 or 4 points, and lost a number of states narrowly on election day. So, yeah, part of this is that people kind of baked in the story in mid-October, and the story changed in late October, because a 6-point lead, that would have required a massive, unprecedented polling error. A 3-point lead isn't safe at all, the way her vote was not concentrated in the swing states.
And she did win the popular vote by 2 points, as you said. So would it be accurate to say the national polls got it right, but many state polls got it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's more or less right. I mean, the state polls did fine in a number of states like Colorado and Florida. Not Florida so much, but Colorado, Virginia, Nevada, states like that. Those are states where Clinton met her polls, actually exceeded them a little bit in Nevada. But there were the polls weren't great in the Midwest. By the way, one thing, too, is that we don't have that many great state polls anymore, you know. So it's not like there were dozens of polls from Wisconsin and Pennsylvania showing Clinton with big leads. You might have 1 or 2 high-quality polls in those states, and they did show her ahead. But you also had polls of Iowa, for example, the Des Moines Register poll, which is a great poll there, showing her down 7 points. She wound up losing Iowa by almost 9 or 10 points, and so that could have been a warning sign potentially. You saw, you know, problems for her in Ohio, a state that traditionally is a bellwether state. And yes, she could win without Ohio, but it was a sign that you know, she wasn't running as strongly as President Obama, who, of course, won Ohio twice. And the kind of combination of the white working class vote, or for being more precise, white voters without college degrees, because education was the main predictor, plus a little bit of a decline in African-American turnout, not low, but compared to the historic highs for the first African-American president, that declined a little bit. And that meant all of a sudden, instead of having an Electoral College advantage, Clinton had a disadvantage instead, because these big Midwestern states that are close and have a lot of electoral votes, the Democrats relied historically on a big African-American turnout plus enough white union workers, working class voters turning out. There are not a lot of Hispanics in those states. There are not a lot of college-educated whites in those states. And if that part of the coalition falls apart, then all of a sudden she lost the Electoral College despite winning the popular vote by a pretty big margin.
Nate Silver from 538 with us with his postmortem of the polling and the media during the 2016 campaign, a series of articles coming out now on 538 called The Real Story of 2016. And E, you're on WNYC with Nate Silver. Hello, E.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. Sorry, a bit nervous, but I have a question for Nate. I don't know if you're familiar with the This American Life story over the summer regarding a colleague of yours, Harry, one of your pollsters, and measuring. He was. They wanted to know why. How come 538 and other pollsters missed Trump's primary? Was unable to predict Trump's primary win, and Harry talked about they failed to sort of like measure or understand the enthusiasm of Trump supporters versus the other candidates. And so I'm wondering, was it a situation again in the presidential for the presidential race where there was a failure by pollsters to measure to take into consideration that there was more perhaps more enthusiasm amongst Trump supporters than for Hillary supporters?
So, I mean, I think that might be a part of the story, but it turns out that turnout wound up being pretty high, that Clinton got about as many votes as President Obama did 4 years ago, so not record-setting turnout, but reasonably high turnout. What it looks like happened to me is that you had all these undecided voters and some third-party voters who broke toward Trump, especially in the Midwest, over the last week of the campaign. So people talk about, oh, Wisconsin, oh, Clinton, the polls were way off in Wisconsin. If you look at the polls in Wisconsin, they had Clinton at about 46% and Trump at about 42 or 43%. That wound up being Trump 48, Clinton 47. So Clinton actually did as well as her polls projected, or a point or so better. But Trump visited Wisconsin and Clinton didn't in the last weeks of the campaign. The news cycle in the last weeks of the campaign was favorable to Clinton and unfavorable to Clinton and favorable to Trump. Trump had spoken the whole campaign to voters like the people who lived in Wisconsin, and Clinton maybe hadn't as much. And so, you know, a pollster can't do very much about voters who are undecided. But what you can do if you're modeling the election or writing about the election or reporting on the election is say, look, if both candidates are stuck in the low to mid-40s somewhere, then there's uncertainty about what this outcome would be. But, you know, again, my basic position is that the polls did in the primaries a pretty good job, actually. They kind of correctly discerned early on that Trump was popular with big parts of the Republican base. And the general election, the polls were okay, not as bad as reputed, not great either. But people, I think, and we had this mistake in the primary and learned our lesson, I think, in the general election, people came up with all sorts of clever reasons to disbelieve the poll showing that Trump could win the nomination and then the presidency. And that might reflect a sort of, you know, liberal media bias, I don't know. And again, you know, we learned this the hard way ourselves, and I think that made us more careful about saying, you know, oh, because it's easy to say, oh, look, the polls are close, but, you know, we all know Clinton's really going to win. We did not write about the general election that way. We took Trump's chances seriously because we know that we had been burned in the past by kind of filtering the data through our own bubble and ignoring polls that showed a very competitive election.
Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Brian. Thanks. I thought there were several factors that confounded pollsters. Let me just list a few very quickly. I think that Trump drew from non-traditional populations, some Democrats, some conservatives. Also, when you have a close election, many minor factors become major factors. And also the polling selection. Who do you poll? Do you poll representative groups or groups that tend not to answer the phone or take questions? And the final thing is there was conservative-leaning pollsters that had Trump ahead. I'm looking at the polls right now. His popularity is anywhere from 53 to 35. How could that be? You think that the mainstream was taking the more liberal pollsters for granted, and I think that's what swayed them.
Nate, where do you want to jump in there?
Well, look, first of all, the fact that, and that's right, if you look at Trump's approval ratings right now, then I see a range on Real Clear Politics anywhere from a 36% approval rating to a 55% approval rating, right? And likewise, in the polls of the popular vote, for example, you saw everything from a Trump lead of 3 points in the Los Angeles Times poll to a Clinton lead of 6 or 7 or 8 points in a couple of polls. So that alone should give you a clue that polling is not an exact science. And so, you know, again, this is why we were kind of flummoxed when it was like you have Clinton with a 2 or 3 point lead in the polling average, but you have a big spread even among good pollsters and how those numbers are determined and how they're calculated. Only about 10% of people respond to polls now, even the best polls. And so all the polls are making some inferences and some assumptions about have we really captured the electorate. So to me, that's why I kind of say, look, the polls were a couple of points off. Well, both based on history and based on kind of common sense, if you actually look at polling is a difficult thing to do well in this day and age, then you need to build in kind of a tolerance for error. And I think that description was lacking because the media had non-polling reasons why they thought Clinton would win. They had assumptions, and they found ways to confirm those assumptions in again polling data that didn't always show Clinton doing
well. So this is really one of your big conclusions, because I think you've said it a few ways now already, that major news organizations, people at major news organizations, were reading the polls that actually showed a fairly close race with bias. Not to help Hillary Clinton, but because their assumption was, oh, well, there couldn't be that many people voting for Donald Trump because he's so disqualifying of himself in so many ways. And so there was kind of an unintentional bias that made people spin it in too much of a complacent way relative to what the numbers actually were. Is that one of your main points?
That's the thesis, yeah, that you know, we think the polling actually showed and the other data showed a competitive race with Clinton favor, but a race that should have been characterized as quite uncertain, especially in the last 10 days of the campaign. One thing, too, that has occurred to me in writing this piece is that, you know, we don't have that much diversity in the media in a lot of ways, but including geographic diversity, where the way the Times and the Post and the Journal covers the race and the major networks cover the race. I mean, they have an awful lot of influence in how other journalists perceive the race and how Americans who watch the news perceive the race. And so, you know, I do wonder if you had, like you used to have, more reporters from newspapers in Iowa and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and they had been more of a part of the conversation, whether there would have been less kind of groupthink about the outcome.
We'll continue in a minute with Nate Silver from 538 and his new series of articles, The Real Story of 2016. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Nate, with his consistent deep dive into all these numbers, if there's any way to quantify the effect of the Russian hacks and WikiLeaks publication of those John Podesta and DNC emails on the actual outcome of the race. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Nate Silver from 538 and his new series, The Real Story of 2016. Nate, is there any way to quantify the effects of the WikiLeaks articles and or publication of the Russian hacks, all the John Podesta stuff and DNC emails? Did it tip the election?
Well, what's easier to quantify is the Comey letter on October 28th, because that was a discrete event. It happened, it upended the news cycle, and that was enough to coincide with a swing of about 3 points from away from Clinton, and that's, you know, larger than the margin that she lost by in Pennsylvania and other states. You know, the WikiLeaks stuff is harder because it was drip, drip, drip. If you look at the amount of people who were looking for information about it, it was actually quite a lot. Like, Google searches for WikiLeaks was as high as it was for the FBI stories, for example. So I suspect it had some effect, and it is the case that when you have an election where, again, you had three decisive states that were within less than 100,000 votes, you know, a lot of things could have mattered, and this is possibly one of them. But because there were things coming out every day instead of just one bang event, you know, you would have to apply a more careful, I would say, methodology. So I want to be careful about you know, it's not a smoking gun the way the Comey letter is, I guess I would say.
So how close would you come to saying, from your statistical analysis, had that Comey letter not happened, that Hillary Clinton would be the president of the United States today?
I think that's probably true. And again, the easiest things to measure are a discrete event near the end of the campaign. So we know that when you have debates, for example, or conventions, and one candidate is particularly well on those, you see a shift of around 3 points, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes less after a debate. And this looked like a post-debate type shift, where you can kind of date when a poll is, and the polls taken after the Comey letter story came out showed almost in every case a decline for Clinton. And again, if this had happened, it was almost like the timing was bad for her in both ways, right? I mean, if it happened, say, in September, then the news cycle would have turned to other things, mm-hmm. and as the story was reported out. But it kind of came at the, and it sounds like a cliche, but like the worst possible time for her, right, where you had this big population of undecideds. I mean, look, the one thing you can say is that Clinton had not sealed the deal with enough voters. She was at about 45%, 46% of the vote at the time that letter hit. She wound up getting to 48%, but most of the people who hadn't decided yet went toward Trump, especially in the Midwest, where he won voters who decided in the last week by a 3-2 margin, or 2-1, I think, in Wisconsin. And so, you know, she hadn't done quite enough to seal the deal when that letter hit. At the same time, if that story hadn't happened, then it was a close election. We know that moved the polls, and so I think we probably would have had a different outcome.
And then when he came out a week later, just a couple of days before the election, and said, yeah, we looked at all this stuff, and really, I know I issued that letter, but there was nothing new there after all, so case closed again. Was it too close to the election to undo the damage?
I mean, the Clinton campaign, in comments they've made publicly, thought that might have hurt them too, because whenever people saw Clinton FBI emails in the same headlines, that they kind of had an impressionistic view that was bad. You know, I'm not sure about that. The problem is that happened so close to the end of the election that it couldn't really be measured by the polling either way. Again, you know, the one thing we know, we have lots of evidence about, is that undecided voters, late deciders, mostly broke toward Trump. And, you know, the combination of maybe her campaign not having a message. By the way, one of the things that happened, too, is that there were lots of voters, of course, who disliked both Clinton and Trump, and those voters broke strongly for Trump.
Huh.
So there are lots of things you can critique about the Clinton campaign, including, you know, they did a good job of making Trump unpopular, but they didn't mm-hmm. have a strategy to deal with voters who disliked both candidates, I don't think. And when the last recollection that voters had wasn't about the debates, where Clinton did do well, according to the polls, but you know,
Comey.
But FBI and WikiLeaks and Comey, then maybe it was natural that those voters said, you know what, I'm going to take a chance on Trump, even though I have my reservations about both candidates.
Peter in Spanish Harlem, you're on WNYC with Nate Silver. Hi, Peter.
Hey, I had a more general question about the reductionism required by the type of statistical analysis that's now become largely associated with Nate Silver. I'm not really sure how much he embraces that and how much it's just a media association. But I also generally had a comment relating to what you were just saying about how so many voters decisively seemed to break for Trump, even though they had disliked both candidates leading up to that point. I know a lot of people who are generally skeptical about the idea that the government that we have as it exists, not just in terms of the president, but the actual structure of the government down to the constitutional order that it's based on, they're skeptical that it can deliver the types of like freedom and progress they want to see from this country. And they want to see a much larger revolution than that, but they're afraid to say that out loud. And I know a lot of those people who think that Trump is a much easier person to rebel against, and who voted in the end, even though they thought both candidates were bad, and they thought Trump was really bad because of his, you know, racism and his nationalism and all this, they thought that it would be easier to resist a Trump than to resist a Clinton.
Interesting. Nate, anything on that?
I mean, look, if a candidate wins a major party nomination, then that candidate has enough support among a large enough fraction of the American public to potentially win the general election, right? And so in some ways, that's why I still think the bigger shock was Trump winning the nomination in the first place, and he had 17 candidates, by the way, instead of two. You know, in some ways, that was the bigger accomplishment, and in some ways, that was the moment when we did say, and people should have said, boy, the assumptions that journalists made about America, maybe, or at least journalists in the kind of New York bubble, you know, maybe weren't a complete rendering of how Americans really felt.
How does that pertain specifically to women, white women, who so many people in the media were shocked that Trump carried with 53%, including 45% of college-educated white women?
I mean, so what we saw is that this divide in education levels kind of transcended everything else. So not just in the white vote did you see a big split among education levels and among white women and college-educated white women, but also among the Hispanic vote, for example. You saw more of a spread based on education levels and geography, where, you know, people forget now that Clinton actually improved over Obama in a lot of cities and a lot of well-heeled suburbs and college towns and a few other places that have high education levels. But then communities in Ohio that used to be swing areas would go to Trump by 25 points, by astounding margins. And so, you know, that's partly why the polls were confusing, is that Clinton actually beat her polls and beat Obama among certain demographic groups. But, you know where they are mostly. They're in California, which doesn't help in Electoral College. They're in Texas. Clinton came much closer than Democrats have in a long time to winning Texas. Huh. Doesn't help in Electoral College. She'll only lose Texas by 7 or 8 points instead of 15, right? You know, so this coalition this coalition of college-educated whites plus Hispanics is really inefficiently configured. It's very coastal. It might eventually turn Arizona into a blue state. But if the Midwest goes red, that's a really hard electoral map for Democrats.
Nate Silver, the founder and editor-in-chief of ESPN's data journalism site 538, his new series, The Real Story of 2016. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Have a great weekend, everyone. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And okay, everybody, you're frustrated, maybe even horrified by what's going on in politics. So how many of you are therefore planning a political career for yourself to bring positive change to your community? I don't see many hands. And my next guest says this may be an issue for many years to come. In light of her research with students at some of the country's most elite institutions that have historically produced graduates who pursue careers in state or federal elected positions, Shauna Shama is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers Camden, found that while many of these students want to improve their communities, they don't view careers in politics as the most effective and attractive approach to doing so. Shauna Shama wrote about her findings in her new book, Out of the Running: Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and why it matters. And she joins me now. Professor Chavez, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners figuring out your career choices, tell us if you are considering something political. If you recently rejected that idea, why was that? Or maybe this has changed for you since the election. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I see that for your research, you spoke to 750 law and policy school students from Harvard Law, Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Boston's Suffolk University Law School. Can you discuss briefly the history of these schools producing state and federal politicians?
Sure, absolutely. I chose these schools specifically because these are the ones that send the most of their graduates into national level office, and that's the two Harvard schools, Harvard Law and the Kennedy School, kind of far outpace any other university for sending graduates into federally elected office. And then I looked for the school that sends the school within the state that I was in, Massachusetts, that sends the most of its graduates into state level politics, and that was Suffolk Law School. So I recruited this sample deliberately, as we say in the social sciences, as a hard test. I thought these would be the students most likely to kind of already be thinking that way because they're here at these political feeder institutions.
But?
Well, but it turns out they had some really good reasons for in fact, they had thought that way, a lot of them. A lot of them had kind of considered the idea of running for office. And in fact, more than half of them told me in either the survey or the interviews that they had been told, somebody had said, boy, you should really be president or you should run for office, right? But they had generally rejected it for what I thought were some pretty good reasons. And that's what I spend most of the book developing, is this kind of cost versus benefits reward framework.
And 86% of the millennials in your survey said making their community better is a life goal. So this isn't a disinterest in community quality of life, but what, more of a lack of confidence in our political system?
Sure, yeah. Lack of confidence, yes, but it's more than that. It is what I decided was a pretty rational perception of the political system as flawed. So it's not just, we talk a lot about government has lost trust, right? It's lost trust across all age groups and all types of groups, especially since Vietnam and Watergate, right? The trust graph just looks like a kind of a falling lead balloon. But this is beyond that. This is, you know, some really well-meaning and intelligent, bright young people who I thought would be totally wonderful to have in office, and who I would rather have represent me than some of the people that, you know, are elected right now. These are people looking pretty rationally at the political system and saying the change that I would like to see in the world would be very hard or maybe even not possible to produce the way that we've set up politics right now.
So I want to ask you in a minute if you think the results of the November election immediately make your book anachronistic. I hate to ask that, but if
well,
you think,
I hope so, but
or to what extent you think it really is a re-galvanizing moment. But let's start with a caller who has a story to tell along these lines, and it's Arlene in Fairhaven. You're on WNYC. Hi, Arlene.
Brian, thanks so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
A number of years ago, I decided to run for school board in my town. I had no political experience, but I had a real cause, and the cause was that they had stopped teaching grammar in the schools in our town. Sounds crazy, but it's true. And I ran on a grammar platform, and basically bringing back the basics. And I was slandered. I was libeled. My child, who was in sixth grade at the time, was tormented on the playground. He came home in tears one day and said, Mom, all the kids and their parents say that you want to get rid of recess, which, I mean, obviously, I just wanted kids to learn what a semicolon was. And it was so horrible and so vicious that years later, the town was divided. People had, you know, remembered this campaign of infamy. And I will never, ever even consider doing this again. This was school board.
You know? Oh, boy. But I hope the moral of the story is, hey, everybody else, don't even try.
Well, I mean, I don't know what to say about everybody else. I hope they do try. I sincerely hope they do. I just want to say that you know, having been subjected to the process over such a relatively benign campaign, I honestly, I'm so shell-shocked. I don't know where to go from here. I mean, I'm politically active, but I would never put myself out there. Because my family was maligned. You know, it wasn't just me. There was an 11-year-old child involved here.
That sounds like a horror story. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having the courage and fortitude to do that in public after what it sounds like you went through. Professor, go ahead.
What an amazing story, first of all, and I'm so grateful to Arlene that she told us about it and also tried to do something good for her community, and I deeply appreciate the grammar platform. But it is such a perfect illustration of what, and these were people I was talking to who had never run, but I think they were looking ahead and anticipating just such an occasion, and particularly the idea of their families being attacked, turned off both men and women, right? And this was an interesting place I did not see. There were a lot of gender differences, but this was not one of them. Both men and women hated the idea that their family, their spouse or their kids would then have to be kind of part of the campaign in a negative way. And I don't think, Brian, the solution is just don't run. I mean, that's clearly, I think, the lesson that Arlene took, and that, unfortunately, and that a lot of the young people I talk to are taking. But what I'm hoping is that it's a lesson more for the rest of us, not the candidates, but the rest of us who need to learn that people who put themselves forward for public service, you know, are human beings and, first of all, worthy of some respect. You know, but also has some flaws. That we treat people just awfully when they volunteer to be our representatives. It's kind of astounding to me.
And it's funny that she mentioned school board only because I was going to mention that since the election, I've had a few different liberal guests horrified by Trump who say the first thing you should do after attending a protest is run for school board or community board or something attainable and hyper-local like that. And, right. You know, and I think that doesn't necessarily weaken Trump, but is that the advice that you would give to the suddenly highly alienated or motivated?
Maybe, but the first thing to do, I think, is not to run for something until you've gotten involved in local politics in kind of a meaningful way and see what it's about and what it's like and what you would want to run for. You know, I don't recommend everybody just go out and run, but I do think that we have let the grassroots atrophy a little. And in particular, the Tea Party has been far more effective in the last couple of years than the left in kind of really getting its people into the grassroots level of governance. So, I mean, there's just thousands and thousands of positions that are not necessarily elected, but that could lead then to elected office. And maybe with a less, hopefully, a less acrimonious and less vicious campaign if you were already the ward boss or, you know, a party leader, that you would know people kind of in local government, know what local government can do, and first of all, where you would want to run. And then also people would know you. One of the biggest problems I think we're seeing, and it sounds like Arlene had this problem, is that voters, it sounds like, are just not giving candidates the benefit of the doubt that the candidate's heart is in the right place. And whatever your political position, whatever your party or your policy preferences, my hope is that politics could mean something different than it does right now. Like a lot of my respondents see politics as old white men shouting at each other, which to me as a political scientist is just heartbreaking, right? That democracy depends on people who are diverse finding a way to compromise. So especially at the grassroots, especially at the town level, if we could find a way to think that politics is the way that we avoid violence. Politics is hopefully good people working together to get something done. And what if Arlene could have gotten the benefit of the doubt to say, I care about grammar because, and she could have explained herself instead of people just jumping on her. I mean, it's just this immediate jump to viciousness, which is so dangerous in a democracy.
My guest is Rutgers Camden professor Shauna Chamez with her new book, Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. And Drew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Drew. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay. Thank you.
I am calling because I am a millennial. I'm 25. I work in local politics. And increasingly over the last 2 years, I'd say, especially with the election, I've been thinking more and more about running. And, you know, Barack Obama said it in his farewell speech to the nation that if you're upset with the state of things, with the status quo, you should grab a clipboard and run. And that's something on my mind for sure. But I am still ambivalent about it. I think your previous call with the school board hit one of my apprehensions about, you know, your name being dragged through the mud and really putting yourself out there very vulnerably in the public. And that may not be good for people around you or just your own self-esteem. And then the other thing for me personally is when the right time is, right? I think I have the energy to do it. I could have the energy to do it now, but maybe not the expertise or the experience necessary, but then if I wait 15, 20 years, then I'm like an old white guy as opposed to someone with energy right now. And then the last thing I think about in New York specifically is being called a carpetbagger. I moved here when I was 18, but I'm not from here, and that's sometimes an issue for certain constituencies.
And if you're not going to run, what are some of the alternatives that you're looking at for yourself for remaining politically active in other ways? I'm just curious.
Sure. So I enjoy my job right now. I don't want to say who I work for, but I'm a liaison for a city politician.
Sure.
And I enjoy working in that field. I'm looking at going to grad school for urban planning to get more involved in the land use side of things because I don't have those hard skills. And I think there's plenty of room behind the scenes, so to speak, to influence a elected official from their office as opposed to directly as an elected official. But I also believe that we're really seeing a trend towards like the need for local or younger elected officials, like new blood, because I think some of the older Democrats are stuck in kind of a centrist business transaction type way of governing, whereas the younger people my age might be able to bring more idealism in and really shift the party and the politics to the left, which personally I would like to see. I know probably not everyone agrees with that, but that's how I feel. And I think that would be the difference between me running versus working for someone in their 50s who's also a Democrat nominally.
Well, when you're elected president in 2044, we will go back to this phone call and replay the tape. And go, Drew, that guy, President Drew, he called the shows like way back in 2017. Drew, thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you, Brian.
So your book, Professor Chamez, is really about running for office per se. And Drew's an example of somebody who works behind the scenes for an elected official. And there are many ways to work in politics without running for office yourself if you want to avoid all those pitfalls that you identify, like having your name dragged through the mud publicly and everything else. Do you see that as a less viable or less useful option? Or why didn't you focus the book on that as well?
It's a great question. I had a whole lot of people in my interviews tell me that they don't want to be the candidate and that they really want to be the strategist. Like there's a whole lot of people. I also had people tell me they'd like to run an executive agency, right? They don't want to be the head of the EPA or something like that, but not be the candidate themselves, which is lovely. And we also need people who will staff the bureaucracy. We need people who will staff the campaigns. We need people who will staff the congressional offices. Those are deeply important positions. But ultimately, all of those positions are accountable to elected officials. And in a democracy, the source of accountability, the source of actual will is supposed to be from the vote. So ultimately, we need candidates who are going to be more than the puppets of everybody behind the scenes. And I understand the impulse to not want to be in the public spotlight in the way that Arlene was, or the impulse to feel like maybe I could do more good behind the scenes. I think that's definitely true, but the fact is that we need people in both positions. And if we've got a lot of good people behind the scenes, which, for example, might be the federal bureaucracy right now, we're still going to have politically elected people and then politically appointed people who are appointed by the elected people who are the head of all those agencies. And we're seeing this play out right now in the federal bureaucracy. It's not going great for the long-term employees.
So we've heard from two callers. One has actually been through it, afraid of their lives and their families' lives being dragged through the mud as a deterrent to running for office. A couple of the other big ones that you mentioned in the book, you said almost 70% of the students you surveyed said that raising money was an unattractive aspect of politics, and that was the most mentioned deterrent. The second most cited reason was that millennials didn't want to pursue a career in politics because of race bias and double standards. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So let me start with the raising money thing, largely because I think this is so unusual how we do it here in comparison to like almost every other advanced post-industrial democracy. The way that we have individual candidates raise all of their or most of their campaign funds individually, it is like totally weird comparatively, and in some sense a little weird historically, right? This is, I think, a fairly terrible system, because what it means is that the candidate doesn't get to really be just a candidate. Most of all, what they are is fundraiser in chief. And some estimates put, even once you are elected, once you're serving, some congressmen spend up to 70% of their time dialing for dollars. So there's kind of a really, again, what I thought was a rational deterrent effect that happens for young people looking at the system. And they had, two major reactions to it that I detail in the book. One of them is this individual, like, I don't want to have to ask people for money kind of feeling, which I understand because I don't like doing that either.
Everybody right? hates that. All the politicians hate that.
Like doing that. Surely we are smart enough to come up with a better system than like individual politicians have to go beg for the money they need to like, you know, buy pizzas for their volunteers. Largely, a lot of that is about the media costs. So maybe we could rein that in. In most other democracies, they have free or subsidized media for political candidates. Mm-hmm. They also have spending ceilings, which I think would be such an important idea here, because our spending is just completely out of control and it's rising rapidly, like exponentially every election cycle. The spending gets worse, which is totally great for campaign consultants, and I think not very good for democracy.
Unlimited campaign spending is freedom of speech. Didn't you know that? I don't want to get into it, but that, of course, is Citizens United.
But the Citizens United is particularly saying, not just because it was Buckley v. Vallejo that said, right, you know, unlimited spending is freedom of speech.
Yeah, that was the original one.
Incorrectly decided that the next we exacerbate that incorrect decision by saying corporations are people, right? They are patently not people, right? There's all kinds of differences between corporations and persons. So legally, I think that was just incorrectly decided. And it's not really a legal decision. That's a partisan decision that has greatly decreased trust, I think, in the Supreme Court and in our government as a whole. But what it means is that young people first, don't want to ask people for money. And then secondly, there's this additional factor that I call the ick factor, where they just thought it was icky. Mm-hmm. Even once you've asked, it feels icky to accept it, right? Because then you might be indebted or you might have to compromise your principles. So it feels like corruption rather than trying to do good for people. Even if that's why you're asking for the money, you still have to accept it. And that compromises you.
Julie, let me go to another call. Julie, yes. In the financial district, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Brian. So I come from the private sector. I'm a three-time tech CEO. And my first experience trying to get involved in more public sector work happened when I went to JFK over the last few days to volunteer with the lawyers. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a legal background. But I was so shocked by the layers of infighting and hierarchy and how little could effectively get done, that I don't know that I, as a person who's always worked in the private sector, who is used to moving things quickly because our capital is literally capital, not social capital, I couldn't see myself running for office after witnessing what these NGOs and lawyers were doing, even in the type of work which was clearly critical, which is helping these detainees get through the airport.
What did you see? Because most of the press that these lawyers and other volunteers have gotten has been glowing as, you know, this was the cavalry coming to the rescue when an immigration emergency broke out.
So I actually came to help with the media. I had posted to a group of friends saying that I think that people who are concerned need to get better PR on this because they're labeling some of the issues as progressive issues when I view them as American issues. These detainees are being subject to something that's, in my view and the view of many legal scholars, unconstitutional. And what they insisted on doing was clamping down, not talking to the media in any constructive way, and having very few spokespeople that were able to express the issues in ways that were speaking to normal people, like, say, me, that this is not a progressive cause. This is just something that violates the Constitution. We all agree that this is the law of the land, whether you're a libertarian, a moderate, or a progressive. And I was so baffled by their narrow viewpoint that this was about their NGOs, their progressive cause, and not we're having a violation of the Constitution, and we should do something about that.
So I'm curious for yourself where that leaves you in terms of planning for future involvement in some way.
Well, my plan, I think, is to avoid the apparatus entirely. I also went to the immigration rally at which Chuck Schumer and Gillibrand and every representative I had and didn't know that I had spoke, and felt that it was a lecture to progressives. And I think that what President Trump is doing and many of the issues we're fighting is not political. And I think we should get back to big tent politics, if anyone remembers the term, and say that many of these things are not issues for the Democrats or progressives. They're issues for Americans that want to protect a basic way of life, which is pretty simple. And I'd like us to focus on those issues and not trying to reestablish any particular cause.
By the way, did you say you're a millennial and a three-time tech CEO?
Yeah, I started my first company at 21.
You've had a full life. Maybe you're going to be the president in 2044, who we say, hey, Julie called the show way back when. Thank you very much. I really appreciate, even though it was disheartening, your experience and your point of view. Shauna Sharma says we run out of time. I just want to go back to one other thing that you said before in passing, and that is that there were gender differences among the students who you surveyed in terms of what the biggest deterrents were from running for office. What were those?
So there were both gender and then race within gender differences. And in particular, the women were far more likely than men to see the political world as biased against them. And women of color saw this most of all. And I think that's not a surprise, because I think they are correctly perceiving that, even if they may overestimate the biases. But then particularly seeing the 2016 election, where Hillary Clinton gets slammed for every tiny problem and Trump can get away with just about anything. I mean, that's a tremendous gender double standard that, boy, the millennial women in my sample were very aware of. And they also felt more keenly some of the other things, like having to ask for money, right? That's something that the women didn't want to do. Nobody wanted to do it, but the women didn't want to do it more than the men didn't want to do it, right? So in addition to seeing the same costs and feeling them more keenly, women, and then particularly women of color, saw additional costs and most damaging to their political ambition, And unfortunately, I think, like Julie, they did not see as many rewards as men did on the whole to being involved in politics, right? And they were less tolerant of just being involved for their ego, right? They did not want to be involved unless it could make a difference, which I appreciate. And that's who I'd want in office. I'd want Julie. She sounds amazing. She's in the group kind of least likely to run, unfortunately.
Draft Julie. Draft Julie. Shauna Shamus. Shauna Shamus, Camden Rutgers, Rutgers Camden Professor of Politics, is the author now of Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And thanks to all our callers. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.